Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Aparna Gopalan, and I'm going to be your host today. I had the pleasure of speaking with Professor Sai Balakrishnan, Assistant Professor of City and Urban Planning at UC Berkeley, about her thoroughly researched, lucidly narrated new book, Shareholder Cities: Land Transformations Along Urban Corridors in India. This book came out with the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2019, and examines the novel phenomenon of the conversion of agrarian landowners into urban shareholders in India's new emerging corridor cities. With its keen attention to the historical production of spatial unevenness and its textured ethnography of a crucial yet understudied topic in Indian social science, this book will be essential reading for geographers, anthropologists, historians, and urbanists working in South Asia and beyond. I had the pleasure of speaking with Sai just a few moments earlier. Here's the interview, and I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Sai. I'm so excited to talk to you about your book.
Thank you, Aparna. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
So my first question to you is, what brought you to work at this unique intersection of urban planning and agrarian politics in contemporary Maharashtra?
Yeah, so when I started fieldwork in, started my doctoral research in 2008, India was in the throes of some of the most volatile land conflicts that the country had ever seen. These land conflicts were largely over the commodification of land, the new processes of commodification of land, largely precipitated by the economic liberalization reforms, which had been officially enacted in 1991. And of course, a lot of these land conflicts were taking place within large cities like Delhi, Mumbai, Bengaluru, and there was fascinating work coming out of these cities. But to me, it was very interesting that there was the emergence of a new site of land conflicts that had to do with urban land conflicts, and that was along these economic corridors. So the Indian government, the central government in 2001, as a flagship infrastructure development program, had launched these really massive economic corridor projects. So, of course, the most ambitious of these is the Delhi-Mumbai Industrial Corridor. And the intent of the policymakers was that these economic corridors would be the spines along which new globally competitive cities would be set up, quote-unquote cities like SEZs, special economic zones, gated communities. And, of course, these were being set up on agricultural land. These enclaves were being set up on agricultural land. And to me, this was a fascinating new spatial form of urbanization because it really forces us to understand and theorize urbanization outside the territorial limits of the city. And I think this is particularly important for countries in the global south, like India, South Africa, because if you look at the Indian census, for instance, there are these really absurd, meaningless statistics that say that India is 32% urban, 33% urban. But the way in which urbanization, the urban, is enumerated is only by looking at urban growth within the city. And so these census categories then completely miss out on these vast new frontiers of urbanization, which are actually outside the city, right? And these are the places that are seeing the most accelerated, the most conflictual urban growth. So to me, the research was really motivated by a new spatial form of urban change that I was witnessing when I started my doctoral research. And I do have to acknowledge that the research is really the book, the doctoral research, and then the book is really situated and is very strongly inspired by a heterodox scholarship from both within agrarian and urban studies. So when I say that I'm interested in new spatial forms of urbanization that also incorporate agrarian change, there is a longer tradition of this from within agrarian and urban studies. Neil Brenner's work on planetary urbanization, Gillian Hart's seminal work on black townships in South Africa, which are these in-between spaces, Meenu Tiwari and Sharad Chari's work on industrial clusters in India. So the research was largely inspired by this heterodox scholarship. So in many ways, what the research was trying to do as someone from within urban studies and planning is trying to challenge these binaries of the city and the village, because these new corridor regions do not neatly fit within the categories of city and village. And the research was also trying to challenge the inherited disciplinary binaries of agrarian studies and urban studies.
Great. Thank you for explaining. And I think that leads into my next question, which is about the way you chose to tell the story that you did. So to understand your book, I think the first thing the listeners need to understand is the cast of characters that the book has. And actually, a key argument of your book seems to be that there is this often ignored cast of characters and people based in agrarian space who are essential in the story of understanding India's new urban corridors. Mm-hmm. So could you introduce our listeners to these various groups, like propertied sugar elites, marginal cultivators, private developers, landless workers? What does telling the story of urban corridors with the focus on these actors illuminate?
Yeah, that's a really terrific question. And I mean, there are a few interrelated questions here. So perhaps I could just pass them out a little bit and answer this in parts. Mm-hmm. The first is, yes, precisely that there is a very heterogeneous cast of characters that really cut across the agrarian and urban divide. And to understand these urban enclaves on former agricultural land, so you look at critical urban studies on land markets, on real estate, for instance, it's focused on urban fractions of capital, right? The developers, the mortgage companies, the insurance companies, and it completely elides agrarian propertied classes who are a key actor in India. So to me, one of the first puzzles that I was trying to address in this book is when you map out the most conflictual land conflicts along economic corridors in India, there's a very interesting spatial pattern that emerges, because most of these conflictual land processes along the corridors are actually taking place on former Green Revolution lands, in former Green Revolution regions. And as many of you know, the Green Revolution was this massive agricultural modernization program propagated around the world under the auspices of USAID, Ford Foundation, other Western development agencies. In India, it had its own history. It had its own trajectory, starting in the early 1960s to solve the crisis of India's food shortage. But to me, this was a very, very interesting puzzle, right? Because if you map out the densest concentrations of SEZs, special economic zones, of gated communities, there's almost a neat territorial synchrony onto former Green Revolution regions. And as scholars of the Green Revolution, like Francine Frankel, Barbara Harris-White, and others have shown in their seminal studies, the Green Revolution was an explicit strategy of uneven development. To solve the food crisis, the central government strategically selected certain regions at the expense of others, and it funneled these huge state subsidies in the form of water, irrigation canals, seeds and fertilizers into these regions. And so the Green Revolution regions really became sites of agrarian accumulation. They became the sites where we saw the emergence of agrarian capitalist classes. And to me, it was very interesting that it's precisely these regions of prior agrarian accumulation that are now somehow ripe to leverage the gains of post-liberalization urbanization, right? So to understand how the Green Revolution is related to post-liberalization urban enclaves, it was necessary to bring in this cast of characters that cuts across the urban-rural divide. And one of the main, like I said, when you look at critical urban studies on land, on real estate, most of it coming out of the experiences of Western cities, agrarian classes rarely figure in any of these studies. And one of the main protagonists in this book is the dominant caste, what M.N. Srinivas called the dominant caste, what Professor K. Balagopal called the provincial propertied classes. So when you look at the Green Revolution regions, there are regionally powerful agrarian elites, caste-based agrarian elites that emerged in these regions. And to me, another very, very interesting and important story to tell in this book is you can't have a presentist narrative of these urban enclaves on agricultural land. Right, so to understand the contemporary urban inequalities, the inequalities of these urban enclaves, you really have to historicize it and understand prior geographies of prior uneven geographies of agrarian capitalism. So a big part of the narrative of the book was also to understand how certain middle peasants from the late colonial period get transformed into an agrarian capitalist class and then into an urban propertied and professional class. So this trajectory, which very much relies on caste, right? The intersection of caste and class was a big part of the narrative.
Thank you. That was very illuminating. So following from that, the beginning chapters of the book discuss another transition in a post-liberalization India, which is about the valuation of land. Mm-hmm. You talk about how the basis for land valuation mm-hmm. in Maharashtra and across India has shifted from productivity to location. Mm-hmm. So could you talk more about that shift? How did some land come to be more productive than other land to begin with? And how has the use of productivity for land valuation shifted to more towards location in the late 20th century?
Yeah, so when you look at... So one of the main arguments of the book is that land, of course, has no value by itself, right? And it's infrastructural networks, and it's the biased routing of infrastructural networks that capitalize certain lands and devalorize other lands. So to me, one of the most interesting aspects of working in Western Maharashtra is Western Maharashtra today has some of the most prosperous urban enclaves. And these urban enclaves are located at the epicenter of the Green Revolution. Western Maharashtra has some of the richest, most prosperous sugarcane exporting fields in the country. India is the second largest exporter of sugar in the world after Brazil, and more than 40% of India's sugar exports come from Western Maharashtra. So this region is really the epicenter of cash crop capitalism. But when you historicize the Western Maharashtra land markets, it's very interesting that in the late 19th century, what is now Western Maharashtra was actually an arid scarcity zone. If you look at the atlases, for instance, like the agrarian and ecological atlas produced by Daniel Thorner and Chen in 1930, and they classify this area as an arid scarcity zone. And yet, between the late 19th century to the 1970s, right, just over a period of 60 to 70 years, this arid scarcity zone underwent this dramatic political ecological transformation, and it got transformed into the epicenter of cash crop capitalism. Because those of you who know sugarcane is an extremely water intensive crop. And so I was very interested first in this political ecological transformation. And this was largely a story, it's a complex story that draws on very contingent colonial politics of famines, of the middle peasantry being the backbone of a rising anti-colonial nationalist movement, and also of a post-colonial politics of the Green Revolution, because this region really got transformed into a sugarcane exporting region because of the routing of irrigation canals, because of the huge infusion of irrigation canals. And the main caste group that captured these state subsidies of water in the form of irrigation canals were the dominant caste, this agrarian property caste of the Maratha. And so it's interesting because water then plays a major valorizing role in helping this middle peasant class gain control, economic and political control over the countryside through the capture of state subsidies in the form of water. And the capture of state subsidies in the form of water was crucial because for agricultural land, the main determinant of agricultural land is fertility and location, right? How fertile the land is, which means that you need to have multi-cropping. There has to be an assured supply of water so that you can grow these hybrid seeds, which were being distributed as part of the Green Revolution package. And location, because of course, proximity to the market is important. And so for agricultural land, the main metric for valuing agricultural land is a combination of fertility and location. And so you look, so what I try to do in the book is, you know, one way in which you can actually map agrarian social power in agrarian India, for instance, Green Revolution India, is you can just map the routing of irrigation canals, right? And that gives you a very neat mapping of social power. And it was during this period through socio-spatial segregation that the Marathas, the agrarian propertied class, took control of the most irrigated, fertile agricultural land. And the unirrigated, quote-unquote, wasteland, right, the agriculturally unproductive land, was relegated to marginalized groups. In the Western Maharashtra cases that I'm looking at, particularly to the indigenous groups, the Adivasis. Now, with liberalization, there's a very interesting change that occurs because, of course, there's a retreat of the state from agrarian subsidies. So there are clearly processes of de-agrarianization in India, agrarian distress. And there are these new urban-oriented infrastructure projects like the economic corridors. So with the building of these economic corridors, of the SEZs and other forms of logistics infrastructures, the determinants of valuing land change. The most productive land, the most valuable land for the market, is no longer the combination of fertility and location, but location, location, location. So this gives rise to some very, very interesting dynamics because, for instance, you could have certain Adivasi lands, quote-unquote wastelands, which are owned by Adivasis, which were fairly valueless just a couple of decades back. But now, because of their proximity to the economic corridor, these advantageously located wastelands can fetch a higher market price than even the most disadvantageously located fertile land, right? And so the mapping of land ownership with social power is now getting disrupted with the economic corridors. And this is something that I tried to particularly unpack by looking at agrarian caste class relations and the ways in which the Adivasis of advantageously located wasteland are now using the rising value of their land to really demand new entitlements for themselves.
I think that's one of the most interesting shifts that you trace and one of the most unexpected. But before getting into that, the central three chapters of your book all deal with different privately developed real estate enclaves in the state of Maharashtra. So there's these three cases, Magarpeta City, Lavasa, Lake City, and Khed City. And there's a lot to say about, you know, your insights from the cases. But before we get into that, could you just describe these three cases and tell our listeners about, what led you to choose them?
Yeah. So before I start with the three cases, yes. So the book is structured around these three cases, but perhaps it might be helpful to just give a little bit of context to these three cases. Polani was a major intellectual influence for the book because what I was trying to track through the production of these enclaves, these three enclaves on agricultural land, is really the democratic market encounters in post 1991 India, right? So the economic corridors, like I said, are a flagship infrastructure development program of the post-liberalization Indian state. And the main intent of the economic corridors was that as these corridors pass through agricultural land, they will transform agricultural land, which was one of the most protected commodities under a state-led dirigist economy, into a transnational real estate market. These enclaves were being set up, private firms. There was a new mode of governance for these private enclaves because the traditional responsibilities of local governments, for instance, water and sanitation, garbage removal, these responsibilities were being taken over by private firms. So in many ways, what you were seeing with the economic liberalization reforms and the production of these corridor regions was enclosure of agricultural land and privatization of urban space, right? So this would be what Polani calls the market movement, the marketization of land. But what is very interesting is at precisely the same time economic liberalization reforms were officially enacted in 1991, at precisely the same time between 91 and 93, there's another set of reforms that are introduced by the central government, and that's the democratic decentralization reforms. And one of the key institutions introduced by the 73rd Constitutional Amendment, the Rural Decentralization Laws, is the Gram Sabha. And the Gram Sabha is a key local democratic institution that I focus on in the book. The Gram Sabha the aspirational ideal of the Gram Sabha is that this would be like a village legislature. If the Gram Panchayat, the rural local government, has elected representatives and they're making decisions, any major decision, including a land use decision, has to gain the consent of the Gram Sabha. Right? So the Gram Sabha is envisioned then as this new democratic space, local democratic space, that's really allowing formerly excluded groups, including women, scheduled castes, scheduled tribes, to exercise their voice in public decision making. So in some ways, the Gram Sabha for me exemplifies a kind of a counter movement. So Polanyi's movement, counter movement, and these democratic market struggles were central to the selection of these cases. So in terms of these three cases, the first case is Magarpata City. Magarpata City is located on fertile sugarcane fields. So in many ways, Magarpata, the new enclaves which are being set up in this region, in this Western Maharashtra region, exemplify agrarian privileges in an urbanizing context. Because the same kinds of agrarian caste networks that made a prosperous sugar cultivation possible and agrarian accumulation possible during the Green Revolution are now being reproduced in this Magarpata region. But at the same time, to understand Magarpata, we also have to bring in the Western Ghats region. Because as I said earlier, the Magarpata region, this Western Maharashtra region, was actually an arid scarcity zone. And the water that made this arid scarcity zone into a prosperous sugarcane exporting region actually came from the Western Ghats. So the Western Ghats is an ecologically sensitive mountain range. It has some of the largest rivers that water the Indian subcontinent, including the Krishna. And for this reason, it has one of the highest densities of big dams in the country. And so the second case in the book, Lavasa Lake City, looks at how the Western Ghats region went through a series of dispossession. First, agrarian dispossession due to big dam building, and now urban dispossession due to the building of large private enclaves, such as Lavasa Lake City. And I argue that you cannot understand one without the other. You cannot understand Magarpata without bringing in Lavasa. The impoverishment of the Western Ghats region, the devaluation of the Western Ghats region, was necessary for the prosperity of the Western Maharashtra region. So in some ways, if these two cases are about the reproduction of agrarian privileges and exclusions in an urbanizing context, the third case, which is Cade SEZ, is very interesting because it's located both conceptually as well as physically between these two cases. So the Cade region is not the epicenter of the Green Revolution, but at the same time, it is fairly prosperous. It was not completely impoverished by the Green Revolution. And it's in this region where the Gram Sabha was activated. The Gram Sabha was used by formerly marginalized Adivasis to claim entitlements for themselves. And there is an unsettling, there is a disruption of agrarian caste-based power. So these three cases, then very simply, I mean, one very simple way in which we, I could frame this is what I was trying to do is you have the same economic corridor, and the economic corridor is passing through three varied agrarian property regimes. And these agrarian property regimes then shape the distributional outcomes of the urban enclaves coming up along these economic corridors, right? So depending upon the prior agrarian property regime, the same local democratic institution like the Gram Sabha is variably mobilized in each of these cases. In one case, it is bypassed. In another case, it is co-opted. And in the third case, it's actually activated and functions as some sort of a quasi-public sphere.
So what are the factors which lead to the activation of local democracy? What are the factors which were missing in Magarpata and Lavasa and present in the Khed context? And then also, what are the factors which silence local democracy, which were present in the first two cases and not in the third?
Yeah, so it depends on the balance of power in each of these agrarian property regimes. So in the, perhaps when I'm talking about the Gram Sabha, let me just premise it by saying, on the one hand, when I am selecting the economic corridors as a new unit of analysis to understand agrarian urban capitalist change in India, I'm also selecting the economic corridors because I'm saying that is the new scale of capitalist accumulation in India, right? And on the other hand, the book really focuses on a local democratic institution like the Gram Sabha. So there, a question then arises on the scale mismatch, right? Because the whole point of the economic corridors is that they transgress local jurisdictional boundaries. How then can local democratic institutions like the Gram Sabha be effective as counter movements in Polanyian terms? So I just wanted to place that upfront and say that, of course, I'm aware that we shouldn't fetishize the local, but at the same time, the scale of local governments is really one of the most powerful scales at which citizens interact with the state, right? And that's why the Gram Sabhas became are a very interesting counter movement institution. So to your question precisely as to why they were variably mobilized, land is a state subject in India. Right, so a lot of these land use changes, the decisions are actually taken in the state legislature. The Gram Sabha is a local government, right? So in cases where agrarian power is too entrenched, as in the case of Magarpata, or in cases where agrarian power is too dispersed, as in the case of Lavasa, it was possible for the capitalists to either co-opt or bypass the Gram Sabha completely. But it was in most agrarian regions in India, power is fairly dispersed, like the Khed case. And so it becomes important for agrarian elites, even if the agrarian elites want to benefit from urban real estate, given electoral prospects, future electoral prospects, they have to figure out ways in which they can bring other constituents in the village together, and they also have to legitimize these urban projects. And so cases like Khed, where power is more dispersed, are places where the Gram Sabha can be an effective institution to resist this change, to resist capitalist change.
And in all of this, where is the transformation of landowners into urban shareholders? You mentioned that these cities some of them are valorized because they have come up with this model of inclusive capitalism, which I'm assuming is referring to the way that people whose land is acquired are given shares in these cities. So what is the impact of that model of acquiring land and distributing power on democratic possibilities?
Yeah. So of course, the classic example of this is Magarpata city, which is held up as this case of inclusive capitalism. And there's a very interesting narrative around Magarpata city saying that these farmers were entrepreneurial, and that's the reason why these farmers were able to pull themselves up by the bootstraps and make the transition to urban real estate. But what this narrative of entrepreneurialism, of course, obscures is the vast amount of state subsidies that go into making these private enclaves possible. And it also obscures uneven, unequal caste power, which undergirds these urban enclaves. The reason why the shareholder model poses dangers is if you look at the Cade case, for instance, the Cade SEZ is this in-between case that I spoke about. And it's a very interesting case because there was this private firm, Bharat Forge, which was looking for land to set up this large special economic zone. And they had initially identified fertile land in this cluster of villages, including Kanersar, which is in the Mumbai-Pune, the shadow of the Mumbai-Pune corridor region. When they identified this fertile land, the main opposition came from Maratha landowners. And the Maratha landowners were very wary to give up their fertile agricultural land, because if the SEZ fails, then they've lost their only landed asset, right? And so they negotiated with the private firm, mediated by revenue department bureaucrats, who are, again, very, very important actors. So the agrarian landowners, the Maratha agrarian landowners, negotiated with the private firm, and they decided to change the boundary of the SEZ to only include wasteland. Right? And I think this is a very, very important, this kind of local politics, the messy on-the-ground local politics is very important to understand, because what the Maratha agrarian landowners were doing is they were actually, this was a counter-movement, right, in Polanyian terms. They were seeking to protect their fertile agricultural land from the risks of the market, and instead to give up wasteland, which doesn't pose any risks to them. And this is an important reminder going back to Polanyi, because Polanyi reminds us, you know, when we think about markets and counter movements, it's not only the working class, it's not only the poor, those who stand to lose the most from marketization, who seek counter movements and who seek protection from the state, right? We have big instances, including 2008, where it's the big capitalist classes, it's the big business groups who actually seek the protection of the state through counter movements. And that's what was happening in this Cade SEZ case. So once the boundaries of the SEZ had been redrawn to only include the wasteland, through histories of socio-spatial segregation going back to the Green Revolution, this wasteland was actually owned by an Adivasi group called the Thakurs. But the Thakurs voted, right? And the Thakurs had electoral power. And so the agrarian property classes could not, they needed to pacify the Thakurs. And so there was a very innovative new company which was formed, where Bharat Forge, as the private firm, owns a major chunk of the shares of the SEZ, but 15% of the shares are actually owned by the Thakurs, depending on the land, that the wasteland that they gave up for the SEZ. Now, for many, this may seem to be a win-win situation, because the Thakurs are reaping the benefits of urbanization. They are getting dividends from this SEZ. But the danger of this kind of a shareholding model is that it silences the voices of non-propertied constituents. So in the Thakur settlement, the titles in this particular region, the Thakurs have private property rights. They have titles to their wasteland. And the titles were held by the younger generation men. Most of the women within the household were very unhappy that their husbands had agreed to be a part of the SEZ, because this commodification and privatization of their wasteland now meant, for instance, that they didn't have goats any longer. And with the inflationary market, they didn't have milk to feed their children. Senior citizens, people in their 70s and 80s who were reliant on dairy cooperatives who had livestock, they were also very unhappy because of with the privatization of land. They had lost the only livelihood that they were familiar with. And so all of these intra-household inequalities got further exacerbated because the title was held by the male head of household. But I also have to point out that this region that I looked at in Western Maharashtra has a fairly low incidence of landlessness, right? But of course, you go to other regions in India that have higher incidences of landlessness, and what you're actually perpetuating with this kind of shareholder city model is a form of property citizenship, right? That you have a voice in public decision making if you're a landowner.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what we usually typically, once we've taken up so much of an author's time, try to conclude the interview with the question of what is next. Now, I ask this question, of course, knowing full well the world we're living in, and you know how what's next may very well be just some R&R. So what is next for you in terms of research, in terms of you know, teaching, in terms of what's happening in the world?
Seriously, I mean, if there's one big lesson for a planner with this pandemic, it's that you can't plan, right? You can only plan for uncertainty. You know, after the book came out last November, and unfortunately the pandemic hit, and for those of us in India, we've been witnessing a really brutal series of lockdowns. And more people have died in India, more migrants, poor migrants have died in India because of the lockdown than they have due to the coronavirus. So, in terms of my next research, let me just do it in two parts. I recently, just being a witness, I'm now in Bengaluru. I've been in Bengaluru since January. And just being a witness to this really brutal migrant crisis, you know, when the lockdown was imposed in India, and of course, the Prime Minister decided to impose a lockdown for a country of 1.3 billion with 4 hours notice. Mm-hmm. When it was imposed, urban migrant workers were locked within the city, right? They were kettled within the city because the city boundaries had been sealed and district boundaries had also been sealed. And within days, there were these really horrific, horrific media images that had started pouring in of migrants who were, who had decided to walk back to their home villages on foot, right? Because not only had the jurisdictional boundaries been sealed, but public transport had also been suspended. The railways had been suspended. Public buses had been suspended. And so they decided to undertake these really treacherous journeys on foot. And what was most really poignant, horrifying, was the long distances that they had to travel, right? Because many of these migrants were walking almost across the breadth of the country. They had come in search of work to the western part of the country, and now they were walking back to their home villages in the eastern part of the country. And to me, it helped me understand the larger geographical implications of what I was trying to do in this book, because the book, of course, looks at the overlap between economic corridors and former Green Revolution regions in one part of India, in Western Maharashtra. But what became very evident with the migrant crisis is that all of the jobs, the urban jobs, the urban informal jobs, were concentrated in the western part of the the western part of the country, right? And these are the former Green Revolution regions. And these are also the regions with the largest number of SEZs. And it's very important to note here that SEZs, ports, all of these logistics enclaves were classified as essential services during the lockdown, and these capitalist activities continued to thrive, right? So this is where the jobs are, the new capitalist informal exploitative jobs are, but the labor is being exported or expelled from the eastern part of the country, right? And these are the bypassed these are the regions that were bypassed by the Green Revolution and that are now bypassed by capitalist urbanization. So in terms of future work, this is exactly what I'd like to understand further on these geographies of uneven development and this spatial rift, which became very cruelly visible to us with the migrant crisis. This is research. This is also part of research, a larger research work that I'm now doing with Arindam Datta at MIT. Arindam is a colonial era historian. And of course, what I try to do in this book is I try to understand the relationship between post-liberalization urbanization and the former Green Revolution region, right? But that raises the question as to why were certain regions strategically selected as Green Revolution regions? And for this, we actually have to go back to the colonial period and understand colonial era public works, the geography of colonial era public works, including famine protection work. So Arindam is a colonial era historian. And so we've been working on this for 2 years, and we hope to start writing a book manuscript next spring, which really looks at the new geographies of uneven development in India, that very carefully tries to understand this concatenated series of unequal infrastructural developments from the late colonial period to the contemporary moment. So that's in terms of research. In terms of classes, I'll be teaching an undergraduate course in Berkeley. It's a new course which really looks at the new spatial forms of urbanization, right? Because I'm very interested in exploring with students, not just on urbanization limited within the confines of the city, but really these new spatial forms like corridor urbanization, urban peripheries, and the new dispossessions across the agrarian urban divide.
That sounds fascinating, and I can't wait to see once it's out. And yeah, these kinds of insights on the spatialization of inequality are so crucial in this time, perhaps more than ever before. So really looking forward to it. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and for answering questions about your wonderful book. And I wish you all the very best.
Thank you, Aparna. Thank you so much for such an incisive set of questions.